Hey y'all, welcome to episode 7 of the Plaid Pilot Podcast. I'm your host, Todd Weld. 29 years ago this week, Boeing finished production on the 1000th 747. It was a 400 series that served Singapore Airlines until 2012. Today I'll be talking about the history of the 747 and 5 of the coolest variants that have been produced throughout the years. So Boeing lovers, stay tuned. I hope everyone's doing well out there this week, staying safe and that kind of thing. I'm currently in the process of getting my instrument check ride lined up, and that has been a real doozy. I don't know if it's a nationwide problem or if it's more regional or what's going on, but I've been trying to get it on the schedule for over a month now, and I keep running into roadblocks. I do know that the student-to-examiner ratio is pretty crazy right now, so I'm sure that's contributing on some level. But hopefully by next week, I'll have a date nailed down I can share with you guys, so we'll see what happens with that. It's actually been a couple weeks now, but I recently got to add a new airport to my logbook. So, been a while since I've gotten to do that. Seems like I'm flying to the same places most of the time. And so I wanted to share a little bit about that experience, but I also want to get talking about these super cool 747 variants. So towards the end of the show, we'll come back and talk about that a little bit. So I'm on my own today, obviously, I guess. But we will be joined for a short time by our aviator of the week. Mike recently earned his ATP certificate, which, for those who don't know, it's the airline transport pilot. So you've never really made it in aviation. There's always something new to learn or that you can achieve. But as far as FAA certificates go, the ATP is pretty much the pinnacle. You know, once you have your ATP, it usually means you're about to start or you recently started your airline career. So Mike is here to talk to us a little bit about his aviation journey. Hey, Mike.
Hey, what's up, man? Can you hear me?
Yep, I can hear you good. You sound great.
Perfect. What's going on, dude?
Not a whole lot. So you are, I remember we talked about it, and I don't remember, you're from, you're flying out of Delaware right now?
Flying out of Delaware, live in Maryland.
Okay. I guess that's a short drive. I don't know.
Yeah, it's Delaware's pretty small altogether, so I got about a 50-minute drive to the airport.
Okay.
So it's not too bad.
Gotcha. So how'd you get into aviation?
Dude, I've actually, I did 10 years in the Coast Guard, and eight of my 10 years was aviation search and rescue on helicopters.
Awesome.
So that was my intro to aviation. I was actually on the middle in the Caribbean on the back of a ship, and my boats came to me. He's like, hey, we got flight ops. I was like, for who? I had no idea the Coast Guard had aviation. Like, next thing I know, it's middle of the night, pitch black. And this helicopter comes out of nowhere and lands on the back of the boat. I said, how do I do that? Like, I don't care for this boat stuff, but how do I do that? And long story short, I ended up going to aviation school in the Coast Guard. You're basically an AMP mechanic, but not a certified AMP. So you're Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, is a mechanic. And then like every fourth day, you would stand a search and rescue 24-hour period. So you would get launched on the search and rescue cases. You're basically what other services call a crew chief. We call it a flight mech. So I sat behind the pilots, made sure they didn't get disoriented or, you know, kind of backed them up with watching the gauges, and you made some radio calls for them. And then when it came time to do the rescue, I was the one hanging out the side, lowering the basket down.
Oh, wow.
Picking people out. So it was pretty cool. It it definitely helped with like your crew resource management type stuff, working as a crew, because they couldn't even see what they were hoisting to. I basically have to paint them a mental picture by things that I saw.
Kind of guide them down verbally.
Exactly. So when I was right around my 10-year mark, and that was right around 2013-ish, 14. 14 is when I got out. A good friend of mine that I went to church with, he was a 135 charter company owner. He found out that I was working on helicopters. He said, if you ever get out and you need an AMP job, let me know. And I got out, got my AMP, went and worked for him, turned wrenches for a couple more years after that. And by then I was sitting at about going on 12 years as a mechanic, worked for Falcon Jet right out of Wilmington, Delaware. Got real burned out. And I just said, I need a break. And I started selling wakeboarding boats.
Okay, as a turn in a different direction.
Dude, I just needed something to just collect myself and just have fun again. Like I was working second shift, didn't get to see my wife much. And so I started sailing wakeboarding boats. And I kid you not, the first boat I sold, guy showed up, and shout out to Dwayne Savage. He's my best friend now. He had just a silhouette of a plane on his polo shirt. I said, "Oh, are you in aviation?" He's like, "Yeah, I'm a pilot." I said, "Oh, no kidding." And at the time, he was a captain for a G550. He's now on the 650. Lo and behold, he ended up buying a boat, and he became my best friend. We started boating together, and we were sitting in his backyard, and he said, "Dude, you know everything about planes. You need to become a pilot." I said, "I can't afford it."
Yeah.
And he's like, "Oh, there's ways. There's you know, it's just like any other school." So the more I looked into it, I actually found a school that I used my GI Bill, and I
Okay.
had my entire, all the way from private, instrument, commercial, and all the way up to CFI paid for with my GI Bill. So I did a 2-year program out of community college in Baltimore County. I flew out of Harford County, Zero Whiskey 3. Shout out to them. Those guys are awesome. And then I got a call from the same guy that I was AMP for when I got out of the Coast Guard. And he had started a new 135 company on his own down in Florida. And he just said, "Hey, man, you know, it stinks you don't live in Florida. I'd have a great job opportunity for you." I said, I finished school in 2 months. You tell me where I need to be." And
I can live in Florida if I need to, right?
So I kid you not, it was December. He called me in November. I finished school my last semester in December. In mid-December, I was down in Florida.
Nice.
He had a Cirrus that I flew, SR-22. And I was a maintenance coordinator. I worked in the office like 6 to 5 every day. I'm not made for a desk job, but just kind of flying the desk. And then we being a AMP mechanic, their president of maintenance and I, we would do night missions. We would fly all around the state of Florida with parts,
Oh, nice.
supporting the 135 company, the jets. We worked on 450 SPs, Hawker 800s, and Challenger 603, 604s.
Basically, just like a mobile
So we were
maintenance
just
kind of
nonstop.
thing.
Exactly. And our office was connected to our warehouse. So we would grab the part, throw it in the Cirrus, and him and I would fly to wherever the plane was. Usually we stayed in the state of Florida for the most part. But man, we pulled some hours. We would work in the office, we'd fly through the night, and we'd get back at 4 in the morning, up at 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, back in the office.
Just constant running.
Dude, it was, I don't, I tell my wife, I think I had like weekends included, 10 days off over a year and a half period.
Yeah. So no weekends, basically.
No. But I got to fly. So I was building time. I was getting paid to fly. I built a lot of hours in a short period of time. And when I hit my 1,000 hour mark, they offered me a position as a SIC on a Hawker 800 XP. So that was my first jet. And I mean, you're talking, I've only been flying going on 3 years at that point.
Yeah, so that's incredibly fast to.
Yeah, it was insane, dude. And I was just super thankful. Took that job and flew my butt off on that. Within six months, I think I flew 450 hours, almost 450 hours. Super grateful for that company.
You didn't have the standard, you know, the stereotypical from a young age, like that's the only thing you wanted to do was fly and always, you know, thinking about airplanes and stuff. It was really that Coast Guard service that.
The Coast Guard changed who I was. I mean, for the better. When I was in high school, I would do anything to get out of class. I took the ASVAB, which is the military test, just to get out of class. I didn't study for it or anything. You know, up until I sold boats, I didn't think I would be able to be a pilot. But dude, I took my first flight and I never looked back. I
Yeah.
sold my truck. I got a Studemobile. You know, my wife, God bless her, she was a rock star. Like, I was living off the GI Bill. She had her job, but she kept us floating. It was, I don't think when, since I've started, I don't think I've stopped. Like, now's the time to grind and get the hours in and
Yeah.
keep going.
Get to where you want to be and then throttle back a little bit.
Exactly. And which is crazy you say that, because literally Thursday, last Thursday was my throttle back date. Like, for the first time in since I've started flying, I was like, "Oh my gosh, I think I just reached the goal I wanted to like focus on." With that being said, I jumping back to the flying the Hawker, friend of mine who I connected through from the first maintenance job when I got out of the Coast Guard. He called me and said, "Hey, man, you've been busting your butt." He's like, "I've known you for a long time. This company based out of Delaware is looking for a pilot. They're not hiring. They're only kind of going by word of mouth." He's like, I'm going to recommend you, but you should at least give them an interview." I was like, "Dude, I'm not looking for a job." Like, I was like, I'm happy with." He's like, "Just interview with them, see what they have to say. And if you don't like it, no harm, no foul." I was like, "Yeah, you know what? Why not?" And, I was actually on rotation when I interviewed with them, and it was just like, this can't be real. Like, this seems too good to be true. And they, next thing I know, I'm getting a date for Gulfstream G550 school in Dallas. And I wanted to give my current employer as much heads up as I could. And it just didn't pan out the way I planned. So, hopefully I didn't burn some bridges, but you know, at the end of the day, I had to look out for my own professional growth.
Right. You got to look out for that and do what's best for the family.
Exactly. To looking back, like, I've been flying for just under 4 years.
Now it's just been 4 years.
Yeah. It's,
that's insane. That's
I always felt like I started late. I'm 37. And I always, okay. I've always felt like I wish I would have started flying sooner. I wish I would have started flying like when I was 24, 25. I feel like I'd be so much further along. When this job came along, I was like, "Holy crap, I feel like I just time warped like and made up all that missed time."
Yeah. And yeah, for sure.
I'm just super grateful. Like, I look back and it's just, I've met so many amazing people and it's just the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, if there's anybody out there who is currently, you know, they're working towards ATP, they're looking to fly, you know, airlines or anything at the ATP level, you have any advice that you'd give them?
Just keep pushing. Like, I see a lot of people start and they either get burned out or they slow down. Like, when you start to burn out, that's the time to push. You eat crap in the beginning to eat caviar at the end. There's a saying like that. It's just put in the work in the beginning. Just grind.
I really appreciate you coming on, talking to me about your experience. That's awesome. Congratulations. ATP is obviously, it's not.
Appreciate it, man.
There's no end in aviation. There's always something new to learn how to fly and that kind of thing. But that's definitely, as far as the FAA is concerned, you know, you've made it for sure. So
yeah,
it's always great to talk to people in aviation at different levels and celebrate their wins and their milestones. And it's been one of my favorite things about starting this podcast so far. And I really hope to be able to kind of follow along with these individuals and you know, some of them, we feature their solos and different ratings and stuff. And I hope that in a few months or however long, to be able to go back and celebrate the next rating and then the next one after that. So if you or someone that you know has recently hit an aviation milestone, and either you or they would like to be featured on the Plaid Pilot podcast as aviator or aviatrix of the week, please reach out. I'd love to have you on the show, but I also know that can be kind of intimidating for some people. So I'd also be happy just doing a shout out, you know, getting your name out there and celebrating with you that way. So shoot me an email at todd@thepladpilot.com or send a DM on Instagram at @thepladpilot. And of course, if you aren't following the podcast on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts, please do that. Maybe consider rating the show if you've enjoyed it. And definitely follow me on Instagram at @thepladpilot and on Facebook on the Plaid Pilot podcast page. That's a lot of P's. I really appreciate all the support I've gotten so far. As far as podcasts go, we're in a big group right now, but y'all have been so supportive and encouraging, and I can't thank you guys enough. So tell your friends, help me get the word out, and hopefully we'll get to keep hanging out like this for a while. Now, on to the queen of the skies, the Boeing 747. So the Boeing 747, it was the first wide-body jet and the first jet to be dubbed a jumbo jet. A lot of different jets are called jumbo jets nowadays, but the first one that was called the jumbo jet was the 747. So depending on what metric that you go by, length versus capacity versus gross weight, that kind of thing, the 747-8, it can be considered the largest passenger airplane in the world. And it's got a length of 250 feet. So the way the 747 kind of came about, Pan Am was using the 707, and they wanted something at least twice as big, maybe a little bit bigger than the 707, because they figured, you know, if they could have more seats, they could charge less per seat and sort of bring air travel to the masses rather than have it be this, you know, kind of exclusive experience. More people would be able to afford to fly, and it would really change the history of air travel for sure. So it took to the skies for the first time on February 9th, 1969. It was originally planned to fly for the first time on December 17th, the year before, kind of like an homage to the first flight of the Wright brothers in 1903. Unfortunately, technical issues prevented that from happening. So it would have been a cool thing, though, because the 747, it really showcases how far aviation had come in such a short time. You know, the first flight of the Wright brothers was reported to be around 120 feet, and the wingspan of the original 747s was 195 feet, 8 inches. So, you know, with the 400 series, I guess it got a little bit longer. But 195 feet, in a handful of decades, we went from not being able to fly 195 feet, you know, in a straight line, to building airplanes that cover the distance, that same distance between their wings. And it's pretty crazy to think about, I think. In fact, the 747 was so big that Boeing had to build a custom factory just to support the production. And to this day, that factory is the largest building in the world by usable volume. Obviously not the tallest, but just usable volume. Now, you actually used to be able to take tours of this plant, this factory that they built, and go in and actually watch them building aircraft and seeing what they do on a daily basis. But they actually canceled that because of COVID. So it ran from the time the plant opened until 2020 when COVID hit. They shut it down for COVID, and you know, on the website, it still just shows that they're shut down. Couldn't find a date that they have any plans for reopening that to the public. But I think it would be really cool if they ever do open it back up. It'd be a really cool thing to see. So the 747, it also holds the record for most people transported on a commercial flight. The typical 400 series 747 holds somewhere around 400 to a little over 500 people, depending on the particular model. But in 1991, El Al, the national airline of Israel, began Operation Solomon, which was essentially they had to evacuate 14,500 Jewish refugees from Ethiopia. One of those flights, they transported somewhere around 1,088 people on one single flight. Now, the actual number of people transported is higher than that 10,088, because mothers who had registered for this flight would sneak their children in under their robes or whatever, and, you know, the children weren't registered for the flight. That 10,088 goes back to the registration numbers. And on some of these flights, I don't know if it's this flight in particular, but some of the flights for Operation Solomon, mothers were giving birth to babies while they were en route. So could have happened on this one as well, to kind of throw the numbers off. But we know that the registered number of people was 10,088 or thereabouts, and there were more people than registered that were actually made it onto the airplane. So that may be the topic of an episode in the future. But it's just a really cool, versatile airplane for the kind of things that it could do. So on September 10th of 1993, Boeing rolled out the 1000th 747, which is kind of the reason we're doing this episode in the first place. It went on to fly with Singapore Airlines until 2012, at which point it actually came back to the U.S., and it was converted into a cargo plane and then used by Southern Air until late 2014. So in 2014, they kind of put it away in storage, and then a year later, they just scrapped it. Now, the 747 is actually still in production. As of June, the final three 747s are being built. They're set to be delivered by the end of the year. So an interesting tidbit, those three airplanes, that the last three 747s being built, they're being built for Atlas Air, which used to be none other than Southern Air. So they will have operated the number 1000 and the very last 747 to be produced. And that last one, it'll be the 1,574th, if you include the prototype. So almost 1,600 were made in the 54 years or so that they were producing these aircraft. That's pretty impressive. And it does place the 747 as in the top 10 of the most produced commercial airplanes. Now, while most 747s are used for commercial air travel or cargo operations, there have been several variants that have been custom built or modified to handle some pretty unique missions. So we're going to talk about some of those today. Number one is the shuttle carrier aircraft. So NASA owns two of these modified 100 series 747s that are capable of carrying an entire space shuttle on top for aerial transport. They took possession of the first one back in 1974, and by 1977, it was being used to test the ability to transport the shuttle. So it took them a few years after they got it to finish the modifications. And of course, it goes into this test phase. In these early stages of test, they actually made an escape hatch from the flight deck out the bottom of the fuselage, I guess with the idea that if the added weight and the altered center of gravity, because this is obviously a large shuttle going on top of the airplane in flight, so if that added weight, the altered center of gravity, if they ended up getting the crew in trouble in flight and they weren't able to recover, they could just sneak out the bottom kind of thing. They actually had some pyrotechnics that would open up that door for them, and then they could just hop out. Luckily, testing went according to plan. They never had to use the hatch, and once they made sure that all of the problems were ironed out, they removed the hatch altogether. So obviously, having an entire space shuttle attached to the airplane changes things a bit. A standard 100 series 747 will cruise somewhere around 550 miles an hour and up to the 35,000 foot range. Now, on the modified version, the max airspeed with or without a shuttle attached is around 290 miles an hour. Now, there's some differences in indicated airspeed versus true airspeed, and both of those are different from, you know, your speed across the ground, and we won't really get into the mechanics of that, but it's possible that part of the difference in the two figures goes back to which type of speed is being referenced on these figures, but that's a pretty significant difference, you know, to look at 290 miles an hour versus 550. Another surprising thing that I found was the altitude. The modified shuttle carrier, it cruised significantly lower than its unmodified counterpart. So even without the shuttle attached, NASA's website lists the typical cruise altitude at 24 to 26,000, which is several thousand lower than a typical 747. With the shuttle attached, it generally cruised at 13 to 15,000, and that's not very high up at all for airplanes. You could theoretically, back when they were in use, of course, not anymore, go up to 13,000 feet in a Cessna 172, look over and see a space shuttle hanging out on the back of this 747, just doing space shuttle things. That's insane. And it would have been incredibly cool to be able to do that. Of course, you'd have to descend below 12,500 after a short time to stay legal with oxygen requirements, because, you know, 172s aren't pressurized and most don't have oxygen. But anyway, they scrapped the program, so we all missed our chance to get in a 172 and fly next to this shuttle carrier. So the shuttle carrier aircraft were last used to deliver the shuttles to the museums that they're now at. So the last three shuttles that were part of that program, when they decommissioned the program, different museums got those shuttles. Don't actually have in front of me which museums got which shuttles, but they all three went to different museums that they were transported by these shuttle carrier aircraft one last time. And now the carriers themselves are on display. One is at the Space Center Houston, and the other is at Joe Davies Heritage Air Park in Palmdale, California. So last I saw, the Space Center Houston had not opened to the public yet, the exhibit that the shuttle carrier aircraft is at, but hopefully, that if it isn't already, hopefully that one will be soon. All right, number two is the VC-25A. So if you live in the United States and you're an aviation enthusiast, it's very likely that you know this one, even if you don't know that you know this one. Most people just call it Air Force One, although that's only the call sign if the president's on board. But it's the aircraft that was designed to carry the president, and most people just consider it Air Force One, regardless of whether or not he's on it. I accidentally got to see the VC-25 climbing out of Las Vegas one of the last times the president was in Vegas. I'm not sure if it was the last one or not. But I was eating lunch, just watching airplanes because that's how I do. And it flew over on its way out of McCarran. And it was the first time in my memory that I have seen it. I know I've seen it. I talked about it on a couple episodes ago. As a baby, I actually got to see the aircraft. But I obviously don't remember that. This is the only time I've seen it in real life that I have a memory of. So that was pretty cool. So there is actually two of these highly modified 200 series 747s. Of course, their primary mission is presidential transport, but they've also been used for vice presidential transport. And when that's the case, they actually bear the call sign Air Force Two. And the Air Force began using the VC-25 in 1990. Before that, they were using a modified 707, which was known as the VC-137. So as you can probably imagine, a lot of things about this aircraft is classified. The Air Force has released a fair amount of information about it, though. You can find it on their website. We know it has an executive suite. It's complete with an office, a lavatory, and a shower for the president. There's actually two galleys on board. And the VC-25 can provide up to 100 meals in one setting, which is handy because the plane has a capacity for 71 passengers. So I've always kind of thought of Air Force One as, you know, just for the president and a few key members of the cabinet, but it can actually hold 71 passengers. So that's, he can bring a whole lot of people on there, I guess, if he wants to. The speed listed by the Air Force is 630 miles an hour, but it's not listed as top speed, so not sure if it's top speed or cruising speed or what. They're little vague on that one. I wouldn't imagine that it was designed for supersonic capabilities. That 630 miles an hour at the altitudes it flies is like Mach 0.92, so getting really close to the speed of sound. Assuming that it did fly faster than the speed of sound, it wouldn't be the first 747 to exceed Mach 1. It has happened in emergency descents before. The speed has been verified as breaking the sound barrier, and it's not recommended by Boeing on a standard 747 because with supersonic flight, you get a buildup of shock waves, and it can cause damage to the aircraft. So it's certainly a possibility for emergency situations, but unless it has some kind of structural modifications that we're not aware of, I would imagine that supersonic flight, if it can be achieved by the VC-25, is strictly for emergency situations. We do know that the aircraft makes use of electronic countermeasures to protect everybody on board, but the specifics of what those countermeasures are, obviously, is classified. The VC-25, it's capable of aerial refueling, so while there seems to be no published data on exactly how long it can stay airborne for, and again, I'm sure that that's classified, we can assume at least a couple days. Within the next couple years, the VC-25A is actually set to be replaced by a couple of 747-8s that will be modified and given the designation VC-25B. I think 2024 is supposed to be the delivery date. So the 747 has served so well in this capacity. The Dash 8, which is the new and improved version of the 747, it will get to carry on the responsibility. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to the VC-25As at that point. Once the 25B is brought into service, whether they'll go to a museum somewhere, if they're going to keep them around for a backup or something like that. Number three is the large cargo freighter. In 2003, it's almost been 20 years ago now, in case you weren't uncomfortable before, you can think about that, Boeing announced the 787 Dreamliner, although at the time it had a different designation, I think it was the 7-Echo-7, but this new aircraft was supposed to focus on efficiency. Now, the parts needed for the aircraft were too large for standard shipping containers that, you know, they put on ships to transport, so the whole efficiency thing is already off to a poor start. But they have to figure out a way to get parts from their manufacturing locations around the world to the assembly plant that's in Everett, Washington. So they decide for the new airplane, the parts are going to be transported by air. It's quicker anyway, right? But none of the current cargo aircraft could support the size of the parts Boeing wanted to move around. So this includes the Antonov 225, which at the time was the largest aircraft. We know that recently that unfortunately has been destroyed. But at the time, it was the largest cargo aircraft, and or largest aircraft in the world, happened to be a cargo airplane. but it was not large enough to transport the parts that they wanted to be able to move quickly. So lucky for Boeing, they knew a thing or two about aircraft design, so they came up with the large cargo freighter, also known as the LCF or the Dreamlifter, and they were going to use it to start transporting parts. So called it the Dreamlifter because it's lifting parts for the Dreamliner, I guess. So the Dreamlifter took its first flight on September 9th, 2006, which is another This Week in Aviation History moment. The flight took place in Taiwan, which is where the modifications were actually performed. Now, of all the variants on this list, this is the one that looks the least like a 747. If you are familiar with the Beluga aircraft, it's kind of reminiscent of that. Kind of balloons out after the flight deck section. It's not a great look, if you ask me, but apparently it's super functional. And I'm sure a lot of you have seen how the cargo nose on the cargo 747s will actually lift up to allow it to be loaded. This is not that. This is something else. The tail of the airplane actually swings to the side to open for loading. And swings is probably the wrong word here. It has to be open with a modified shipping container handling truck. So this truck that's designed to, you know, handle shipping containers, they modified it. Now it's used to open up the back end of the Dreamlifter. So the tail is rotated away to make room for the parts that have to be loaded, and the parts have to be loaded by the world's largest cargo loader. It's called the DBL-100, and that has to be quite the sight, seeing the world's largest cargo loader loading ridiculously large aircraft parts onto this deformed 747. So, well, I'll definitely share pictures of all of these variants on the Instagram for you guys to see. But definitely has to be something to see this. It's got to be quite a sight. So when it's all loaded up, a series of electronic actuators, I think there's 21 electronic actuators, have to lock the tail to the body of the airplane so it can take off and make sure that that tail stays in place. Obviously, if that tail were to open up in flight, it would be a bad day for everybody. And that back compartment, which is really most of the airplane, is unpressurized because there's really no need to be pressurized if you're just carrying airplane parts. So in June of 2007, the Dreamlifter received its FAA certification. Earlier that year, Boeing actually needed to start moving these parts. Lucky for them, they were still able to. They moved parts to Washington from different parts of the world as part of the LCF's test program starting in early 2007. So I don't know if they, how they got that approved, if they knew someone at the FAA or how they swung that. But so they were essentially using it operationally as part of its test program. So today there are actually 4 Dreamlifters moving parts around the globe. And usually it is just airplane parts, but on one occasion in July of 2020, they actually carried a shipment of PPE, you know, to support the COVID situation. They carried that shipment into Salt Lake City in Utah, and I'm not sure how they ended up with that mission. It seems kind of strange. I know it was a collaboration between the state and some different corporations, but somehow or another they ended up carrying a bunch of PPE into Utah. And there was a small incident with the Dreamlifters when Atlas Air, those guys seem to keep popping up in the 747 story. In November of 2013, they actually landed one of these Dreamlifters at a general aviation airport in Wichita, Kansas. So apparently it was on the same heading as McConnell Air Force Base. They must have been coming in from, the northeast. It's about 9 miles further northeast than McConnell Air Force Base, but it's on that same heading. And they misidentified the airport, and they safely landed on the 6,000-foot runway. The takeoff run at max weight is something like 9,200 feet for the Dreamlifter. This is fully loaded. It must not have been fully loaded at the time because they were able to take off from the 6,000-foot runway, and nobody was hurt. Nothing was damaged. No one was hurt. So all in all, a good ending to that story. But imagine having to explain that situation. You know, they had to have been cleared to land at McConnell, being an Air Force base. At some point, they had clearance to land. They get on the ground on this runway that's half the length that it should have been if they were where they were supposed to be. And I'm sure they lost comms. Maybe not, because Kansas can be pretty flat. But they probably lost comms, being 9 miles away on the ground. And I would just have loved to see that unfold, sitting on the flight deck as they tried to figure out what was going on. They're in this massive airplane and a relatively small airport. Just the phone call had to have been ridiculous. But it definitely could have ended poorly. So it's good nobody was hurt, and just makes for a humorous story that we can all learn from. Number four is the E-4 Night Watch. Now, at first glance, you might mistake the E-4 for the VC-25, you know, the Air Force One we were just talking about. You know, it has a similar livery to this VC-25, but the Air Force has actually been using the E-4, which is just a modified 200 series 747. They call it the Advanced Airborne Command Post, since 1974. Something cool about the E-4, unlike most of the planes on this list that were built with or were upgraded with fancy, you know, avionics suites, flight instruments, and that kind of thing, the Night Watch uses all analog instruments. So as an airborne command post, one of the major concerns is its ability to survive an EMP blast, an electromagnetic pulse, which can actually take out computers and all that kind of stuff. So they built this, or back in 1974, they probably just used what they had back then, but they just never upgraded it like a lot of them have been upgraded, because they want to make sure that those analog instruments stay online if we ever experience an EMP blast. So the first E-4 became operational in 1980, and there are four currently in use by the Air Force. Of those four, there's always at least one. One of them is always kept on standby, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So obviously the primary mission of this command post backup during an attack on the U.S., it's one that we don't worry about too much. So it also serves an auxiliary role of support for the Secretary of Defense when they travel outside the continental U.S. The aircraft, like the VC-25, it's capable of aerial refueling. And according to popular mechanics, it can stay airborne for an entire week with its crew of 112. So it's interesting to me that we have no data on how long the VC-25 can stay airborne for. But at least according to popular mechanics, and I don't know where they got their information, but they are saying that the E-4 can stay airborne for an entire week. And, you know, on airplanes, the oils and the fluids that keep the airplane operating properly, they have a lifespan. And I know for a lot of aviation oils, it's something in the 50-hour range. And a week of straight operations is like 168 hours, over three times that 50-hour mark that normally you would want to see an oil change. So it's possible there's a modification that allows extra operating time, maybe some way to constantly cycle new fluids into the systems. I don't know. But I'm sure that if it's accurate, they have, you know, if this, I'm not sure, but if that weak figure is accurate for the E-4, I can't imagine that the VC-25 wouldn't have a similar endurance figure. So the Department of Defense has actually talked about retiring the aircraft in the past. The last 15 years, at least once, it's kind of been on the chopping block, but it's the only airframe that can do what this does. You know, being that no other airplane can have these capabilities, the forced retirement has been scrapped for now. But you know, as aircraft age, the time and the money that are needed to maintain them increases with age. And for the E-4, it looks like that time and money becomes prohibitive sometime this decade. So in the next 7 to 8 years, we can assume that it'll become cost prohibitive to continue to operate the E-4, but the Air Force is working on the Survivable Airborne Operations Center, which eventually will replace it. Number five is SOFIA. SOFIA stands for the Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy, and it's the only variant on this list that's one of a kind. All the others, they have an identical or at least a very similar aircraft that shares its modifications, but SOFIA is one of a kind. So before SOFIA became SOFIA, it actually flew for Pan Am beginning in 1977, and it was actually christened Clipper Lindbergh by Ann Lindbergh. Of course, this was in 1977. Ann Lindbergh is at this point, Charles Lindbergh's widow. And she got to christen the airplane that would become Sophia on the 50th anniversary of Charles actually setting out for his transatlantic flight. So that's kind of a cool thing. So it changed hands a few times over the next 20 years. It eventually ended up with NASA, and NASA performed some flight testing prior to any modifications, I guess to make sure things were all as they should be, get a baseline for the airplane before they start cutting into it. Apparently, everything checked out, everything was good, and in 1998, the company that would eventually become L3, it was a different company at the time, but mergers and that kind of thing, eventually it would become L3, they modified the plane to hold a 2.5-meter infrared scope telescope that could be used in flight. So this project's actually a joint effort between NASA and the German Aerospace Center. NASA kind of handles the aircraft side of the house, and Germany handles the telescope/science side of the house. But it's a joint venture between the two. So the aircraft flies 3 or 4 times a week, gathers infrared data from space. It flies at over 40,000 feet, and this helps make sure that there's limited water vapor. You know, in the lower atmosphere, if you try and take these infrared readings, all of the water vapor in the lower atmosphere will impact those observations, can block some of the IR and that kind of thing. So with these readings, scientists are actually able to analyze the atmospheric makeup of other planets and even objects outside our solar system. So to give the telescope that's, you know, built into the airplane a view of the sky, a door on the fuselage actually has to open up in flight, and surprisingly, it has little aerodynamic impact on the airplane to have that door open. I'll post pictures of this one, too, on Instagram so everyone can see what that kind of looks like, and it definitely looks like it would negatively impact the flight characteristics, but apparently it doesn't, at least not to any significant degree. Unfortunately, it was determined that the scientific value that the airplane offered versus the cost of operation didn't really even out. And earlier this year, it was announced that at the end of this month, Sophia will be retired. Now, an act of Congress could theoretically return funding to the program and revive it, keep it from being forced into retirement, but that doesn't really look likely right now. But we'll see what happens. So those are 5 variants of the 747 that you should know about, if you didn't already. If you've never heard of any of these, or you know one in particular, shoot me a message. Let me know which ones you'd heard of before, which ones you haven't. So before we go, I mentioned earlier about adding a new airport to my logbook. So thanks for hanging around, and I'll share a little bit about that before we go. So like I said, this was a couple weeks ago. I was actually supposed to go out to Bryce Canyon for they were having this vintage airplane and car show fly-in. But the weather out here has been kind of iffy. It's been a really crazy monsoon season. And Bryce Canyon on this particular weekend looked even more iffy than the weather here in Vegas. And I kind of wanted to stay closer to home, kind of keep an eye on things and be able to head back before weather took off in the afternoon. So we decided to fly out to Lake Havasu City in Arizona. It's been on my list for a while, and I was kind of bummed to miss out on the cooler weather up in the mountains in Utah, but it ended up being for the best. So I couldn't get my oldest and youngest boys to go, but my middle son wanted to. My oldest is a little apprehensive about flying, kind of like his mama. And my youngest, he actually enjoys flying, but lately he won't go anywhere without mama. So we got to have some time, just the two of us, me and my middle son. And it ended up being a really fun trip. Now, they have a swimming pool on the airport, and we were the only ones there, so had the whole pool to ourselves. And then we went to Hangar 24, I think is what it's called, which is, it's actually known for its wings. I've heard about the wings there for years now, and that was one of the reasons I wanted to try it. So we went there for lunch, and I didn't even try the wings. I had this pulled pork barbecue sandwich. It was really good. In the pilot lounge, they actually had free snow cones and popcorn, and they also had a chessboard set up. So we just hung out there for a short time, had some snow cones, played some chess, cooled off a little bit before heading back. So wanted to beat any storms that might try and pop up in the afternoon. But yeah, it was a really good time. We made it back before any storms popped up. But yeah, it was a really good time. And my son actually flew a good portion of the flight. You know, he's 8, so he can't really see over the panel. But just by looking out the window and watching the HSI, he did a really good job of keeping us level and on course. Of course, I was there to scan for traffic, work the rudder pedals and stuff, because I can't reach those either. But we'll definitely be going back. And then once we got home, kind of talking about how the day went, my oldest son said he actually wants to give flying a try now. I think it was mostly the opportunity to have free snow cones and go swimming. But I'm definitely excited about that as well, and looking forward to getting him up in the air, and hopefully we can all take a trip down there before too long. So if you aren't too far from Lake Havasu City, which is in northwestern Arizona, I highly recommend the airport. Friendly people, really cool environment, and then definitely check out Hangar 24. Well, that's all for this week. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the show and learned something new. If you have, make sure you never miss an episode by following on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you've been listening for a few weeks now, please consider rating or leaving a review. It'd really mean a lot to me to see that. Y'all stay safe this week, and as my wife always says, fluffy landings.